On Medium, we believe that words matter. That's why we're building the best place for words on the internet, all without a single ad, Insight. For just $5 a month, members get unlimited access to the best stories on Medium, stories like the one you'll hear on today's episode. So sign up today at medium.com/membership. Now, enjoy the show. Just a heads up, today's episode contains some sensitive, racially charged language, so you might want to throw some headphones on.
Welcome to Playback. On every episode, we invite an author we love into our studio to read their recent work from Medium. Then we sit down and chat with them to get the story behind the story. I'm your host, Kara Brown, and this is Medium Playback. Today, we're going to switch things up a bit. Instead of featuring just one story, we're going to hear three. Medium recently published a collection called Traveling While Black, and we've invited three of the authors to our studio to read their essays from it. We've got Matteo Ascaripour on what happened to him when he studied abroad in Florence, Jamila Lemieux on being black in first class, and Morgan Jerkins on getting her hair checked by the TSA. Afterwards, we'll chat with Morgan, who curated and edited this collection. Morgan is the New York Times bestselling author of This Will Be My Undoing, Living at the Intersection of Black, Female, and Feminist in White America, and I'm excited to welcome her onto the show. Hi, Morgan, and welcome to Medium Playback.
Hi, Kara. Thanks for having me.
Traveling While Black is packed with stories of black travel that we really haven't heard before. What was the inspiration for creating a collection like this? The experience of traveling as a black person in today's world, and what was the process of putting it together?
Well, first I'll say that I was inspired by a previous series that Medium published with Roxane Gay, and the theme was about bodies. And so I knew of a new editor who just got hired there, features editor, Joe, and he was calling for pitches. And I was like, you know what, even though I'm not editing as much as I used to, I used to be an associate editor at Catapult, I really wanted to curate some type of online anthology. But I was like, how can I bring together a diverse range of writers and also being very specific at the same time, while also being abstract? And so for me, I thought, well, I love traveling, but traveling is, there's so many barriers to traveling as a black person, particularly as a black woman. And starting 2 years ago, I started to take solo trips, and that added another dimension of what it's like to navigate, you know, domestic or international spaces in this body that I have. So what I wanted to do was I thought of people who I know who travel, who have talked to me about traveling just off the cuff over brunch, or I've seen their Instagram stories. And I asked them, I said, hey, do you want to write about what it's like to travel while black? And at first I was going to focus on overseas, but then I had a few authors that were like, well, I want to talk about what it's like traveling even in this country, which I thought was crucial. Important. And so it came together in a very organic way, and I'm very lucky.
Well, I'm excited to hear these stories, so let's get into it. First up, here's Matteo Ascaripour reading his story, Losing Myself in Florence.
In 2010, I was a sophomore studying abroad in Florence, drunk on all the city had to offer. A language people spoke more with their hands than their mouths. Small but filling plates of pasta, gray-haired women unshuttering their windows to let in the morning sun, hills that seem to grow overnight and shrink during the day, the kinetic juxtaposition of white-marbled 13th-century cathedrals and dark-skinned immigrants washing into Europe's boot like the waves they nearly died on to get there. A friend and I traversed the narrow cobblestone streets, wine in our hands and excitement in our hearts. The previous week, we'd met two French art students at Bebop, a club where my friend had weekly gigs. The two art students, one extremely shy, the other unabashedly not, had taken us to a funhouse of sorts, where the top floor was made of beds, with crayons and markers available for body illustrations, and a hedonistic atmosphere hanging in the air like a cloud. It was with this in mind that we accepted their invitation to another party, this one hosted by a young Italian photographer. His apartment was surprisingly large. A handful of people were conversing in French and Italian and sipping red wine out of white plastic cups, seated on couches, embodying the bohemian aesthetic with each movement. The French art student I liked ignored me. I peered into my cup of red wine. My friend, inherently awkward, fidgeted in his chair. The Italian photographer rushed out of the room and returned with a large camera, taking photos, asking people to pose, and spinning around the room like a hurricane. He laughed as friends crowded together, smiled as people froze on cue, unlit cigarettes hanging from their mouths, rims of stained plastic cups kissing their lips. He then told me to stand up and said, in accented English, "Now, hold a gun out, like the nigger from Pulp Fiction." I stood there but was no longer myself. I was Jules Winfield, a hitman who, after a moment of clarity, decided to walk the earth. Jules, played by Samuel L. Jackson, is 6'2", dark-skinned, and sports jerry curls, chops, and a horseshoe mustache. I am 5'7", light-skinned, and had no facial hair nor head hair long enough back then to be called an afro, much less jerry curls. But in that moment, I was the nigger from Pulp Fiction. My effortless transformation didn't stop the flow of French and Italian in the room or turn any heads except for my friends, who now sat with his mouth agape. Why was I the nigger from Pulp Fiction? I still wonder now, 8 years later, revisiting a memory I carelessly thought forgotten. But painful memories are never forgotten, only buried. If I hadn't been the only black man at the party, would another have had his identity transmogrified for pleasure? It would be easy to say that the young photographer didn't mean anything by it, that it was just a joke. But I believe it's deeper than that. Somewhere inside him, he did see me as the nigger from Pulp Fiction. A stand-in, substitute, an embodiment of one of the many entertainment-fed, media-fueled, and shrink-wrapped brands of blackness he was used to. Why didn't he ask my friend, who was Jewish, to strike a pose like Tevye the Dairyman, singing "If I Were a Rich Man" in Fiddler on the Roof? Did he even know my friend was Jewish, or was he just any American studying abroad? Is there any world in which he'd ask my friend to hold a gun like the white cyborg from The Terminator? Wield a sword like the white Scott from Braveheart? Of course not, because my friend was assumed to be of no relation to those characters. His individuality was never in question. When he told me to hold a gun out, like the nigger from Pulp Fiction, the burden of asserting my individuality, of not playing the part, became entirely mine. Because those 10 words, like a spell, instantly rendered me an other. Something that for 4 sweet, unthinkable, and overly generous Mediterranean months I had forgotten I was. Learning the language, being treated well by most Italians, and having a large Senegalese population in the city, already serving as resident others, created a fragile castle of comfort, easily flattened by 10 words. Hold a gun out, like the nigger from Pulp Fiction. I left Florence in May 2010 and returned to the United States. And while the memory of that night buried itself so deeply inside of me that I'd thought it gone, I now realize it's always been there, like a dormant disease, laying in wait for my most vulnerable moments. When I forget that the most dangerous thing a person of color can do is forget they're a person of color, especially in unfamiliar places. This is a paranoia and anxiety I try to ignore, but I often still find it following me around like a shadow, no matter if I'm walking on a cobblestone street in Europe or laying on a white sand beach in Southeast Asia. And although this shadow may prevent me from living in the moment, it is also my protector, ceaselessly whispering, "Never forget, never forget, never forget."
That was Matteo Ascaripour on his story for Medium's Traveling While Black anthology, Losing Myself in Florence. Up next, we're leaving Italy and heading to the security line at LaGuardia. We have Jamila Lemieux and her essay, The Pleasures and Pains of Being Black in First Class.
Priority. A quick downward glance confirmed that the word was, in fact, still printed in big, bold letters at the bottom of my boarding pass, just as it had been when I'd printed it out 10 minutes earlier. So, no, my airline status had not been snatched from me when I slipped outside to quickly hit my vape pen before approaching a TSA agent who would kill my high before it even kicked in. I was at LaGuardia Airport for an early flight to a professional conference in Detroit. And though I wasn't late, I had a limited window of time to get a snack before boarding. One of those moments in which my hard-earned platinum frequent flyer designation should come in handy. I'd get to bypass the long Gen Pop line and be shuffled through the lane for those who either fly often, me, or exclusively in first or business class. Definitely not me. Yet the TSA agent, a black man about my own age, had different plans. He'd almost instinctively sent a young white woman straight through the priority line in front of me. I peeped her ticket, she wasn't supposed to be there, before glancing at my boarding pass and sending me to the regular one. But isn't that priority? I asked. He looked down again. Oh, yeah. Go ahead. Now, I wouldn't tell this story at all if it didn't happen more times than I can count. I've experienced things like this with similarly absurd indicators of one's worth many, many times. Hotel loyalty clubs, VIP lines, executive lounges, private events. It's the extra ID checks, the poring over a slight difference in the formatting of my name on my passport versus other official documents. It's the, ma'am, where are you going? You should be over there. It all speaks to the general sense that if I'm not in a black space, it's hard for people to recognize that I might belong somewhere exclusive, especially if the other faces there are typically white. There are two kinds of madness that accompany the sort of minor slide I encountered at the airport. You see, I took my first flight at the age of 17 and didn't have the means to do much travel until I was in my mid-20s. The fact that I'm now flying an average of twice a month, primarily on business, represents triumph over the financial circumstances I was born into. So I resent being treated like I can't afford or don't deserve a privilege that I worked really hard to get. But on the other hand, is there anything sillier than conferring status via titles like gold and platinum? Or taking pride in getting access to 6 inches of extra leg room, though I am pretty tall, a free cocktail, and at times relishing the opportunity to sit in first class for free? I mean, intellectually, I know this is capitalist nonsense, but as a busy professional, those little perks feel pretty damn nice. So now I have to balance the guilt of being elite adjacent and the weight of being treated like a nigga no matter how many airline miles I rack up. All at once. I'm fortunate to have first world problems like the former, but I'm also frequently sensitive to the fact that they do little to protect me from the latter. I'd be remiss if I didn't acknowledge that my physical appearance, speech patterns, gender, and gender presentation still provide a relative advantage in spaces that aren't designed to see blackness as normal or welcome or worthy of exclusivity. As such, folks who don't see a light-skinned, average-sized, cishet college-trained woman as a business traveler or as someone who gets into exclusive spaces may be even more aggressive in denying access to a darker-hued woman or a large man or a gender nonconforming person or anyone who may speak in the black vernacular English that I typically reserve for an audience of my own people. I actually hate myself today even more than usual for sharing any of this publicly. Again, airline status is corny. And what bourgeois nonsense to waste ink on. And I am increasingly tired of being treated like I don't belong anywhere that isn't presided over by my fellow Negroes. And I'm also really sick of paying for customer service that doesn't seem to be granted to people who look like me when I travel. Alas, that's the grand nature of white supremacy. You're never without at least a microaggression to complain about. But the top line issues are so significant that you feel like an ass for acknowledging the smaller ones at all. And for that reason, and many others, I think I deserve extra leg room and a shorter wait in the security line and a free cocktail after all.
Once again, that was Jamila Lemieux reading her essay, The Pleasures and Pains of Being Black in First Class. Now we'll hear an essay from today's guest and the editor of Traveling While Black, Morgan Jerkins. Here she is with her contribution to the collection, On Getting My Hair Checked by the TSA.
I'm not a first-timer when it comes to getting my hair checked by the TSA. At this point, I've got it down to a science. If I wear braids in a bun, which is the most travel-friendly style because otherwise they can reach down to the end of my back, I know someone is going to put their fingers through my hair. If I wear faux locks or any kind of extensions that give my hair volume, all I have to do is look at the x-ray screen and see a sizable yellow rectangle over the size of my head and know that a black TSA officer will soon emerge from out of nowhere and begin to course through my hair. I've made Facebook statuses about this inconvenience, and white female friends will tell me that they have their hair in buns all the time and never get checked, mentioning this not to discredit my experience but to highlight the inequality. What gets me is that this extra inspection is not universal across U.S. airports. I may not get hair checked at JFK, but I might at LAX. Philadelphia Airport might check me, but not Phoenix. But by far, the most revolting experience happened in Louisiana. I was on my way back to New York after a research trip spanning the Acadiana region, and I had to go through Lafayette Airport. As the white female TSA officer was putting her fingers through my hair, she asked me if I knew the kind of damage the braids do to your hair. She said one woman had hair loss because of it. First, I was not wearing braids. I had Marley twists, which use two strands, not three, of hair to complete each twist, hence the name. Second, I know the potential damage any kind of style that pulls at the root can do to the hair. But I've been wearing variations of these styles for the majority of my life, and my hair has gotten fuller and longer, not shorter and more frail. The conversation aggravated me, but given that I did not want to cause a scene in a small airport, I just said, "Oh," and quickly gathered my bags. A black man saw what was happening and said, "I don't like how she kept you longer than she should have." I immediately vented. Not only did I feel like boundaries were crossed, I told him, but I also felt her admonition incinerated any potential of me being polite. It felt like this woman assumed she knew my body better than I did, or worse, that I was not equipped to protect my own body, and she was just passing along information that might be useful for me and my well-being. I've been traveling since I was a baby, and I've gotten used to the ways in which my body is surveilled both in and out of the airport. I've had a near run-in with neo-Nazis in Russia, landed in a taxi situation where I thought I could have been assaulted in the Bahamas, and had employees refuse to acknowledge me in domestic places like Florida. The constant awareness of what kind of treatment I'll get for being born black and assigned female is often more exhausting than the time it takes to get to and from my destination. But I know I'm not alone, and it's for that reason that I've chosen a mix of emerging and established writers who can also attest to the challenges of traveling while black, demonstrating that anti-blackness is real no matter where you go.
That was Morgan Jerkins reading her story on getting my hair checked by the TSA. Morgan, I'm curious if writing this essay and curating this collection of stories has changed the way you look back on those experiences of being physically violated by TSA agents.
Yeah, I think it has, in a way that writing helps me to slow down. A lot of times when I feel violated, or if I feel interrupted, rather, with the flow of my routine or the flow of my movement, I try to ignore it as quickly as I can. I don't like ruminating on anything that makes me uncomfortable because I don't like dealing with negative feelings, even if it's important to sift through them to get to a place of healing. So in writing this essay, it helped me to realize, like, yeah, it bothers me because it keeps coming up. It's a pattern. And I really want to talk about it in a way that doesn't make it feel like I'm whining. Or I always have this hesitation of telling someone about this experience that I think is about both my race and gender, because it feels belabored. It feels like it's eye roll inducing, but it's something that stops my day. And that is something that I had to really deliberate on a bit more and expand.
How do you, while traveling, not let those things affect the trips that you're going on?
You know, I will say there are times where I try to make a friendly conversation with a TSA officer. Sometimes, depending on the, it can be a Black female TSA officer who comes out and she'll take a pause and look at me because she knows that I'm like, I don't want to go through this again. Like, she can see how my face is crestfallen and she'll be like, I'll be quick or something like that. And, you know, usually when that part is done, I just try to focus on my destination, focus on all the activities that I have planned for when I get there. And that usually serves as a balm, you know, albeit momentarily.
What's been the reaction to this collection?
Enthusiasm. You know, I was a bit surprised by the reception because even though the summer is the time for vacation and relaxation, so much is happening politically. And I was worried that writing about escapism and writing about these privileges that people have to even travel, period, people wouldn't, you know, be receptive to it. And they were.
You, I imagine, have now heard so many stories about people of color, Black people traveling. Have you noticed any specific differences in the domestic versus international travel experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think domestically, and especially because of the time that we're in politically, there's already this heightened sense of awareness. Granted, there might be some places in the United States where you have no idea, you know, the land or terrain, but everyone feels like they have a sense of something in America, whether it's the South, whether it's the North, whether it's the West. Midwest, I think it gets murky, and that's a whole nother topic, but I think we sort of have some type of knowledge, or think we do, about how to navigate these certain regions of the United States. When you're going overseas, I don't know if there's less of a framework to work with if you've never been there before. And also, I think for some people, and I can speak for myself, there's a tinge of idealism because you think about how Black people in the past, for example, went to France, went to Paris because they were like, I can't deal with the American racism here, so I'm going to go overseas. And even though there have been many different narratives since then, it's just the same as is over here. There's still this hope that some place can be better than here.
I know for me, I'm a Black woman, and one of the places that's often mentioned to me as an amazing place for Black women to travel is Italy, which does not always turn out to be true. But in your experience, what were or are the most Black-friendly travel destinations?
The most Black-friendly destination I've been to has been the Bahamas, but that's because the majority of people there are Black. However, I went there as a solo female traveler. And so that adds another dimension because it's like men always want to talk to you. Men don't understand why you're alone. Why aren't you married? Where are your kids? Or they try to push up on you. And then when I think about how I'm thinking about my womanhood now, I can't extricate that from being Black as well because I don't see them pushing up on white female tourists the same way. So yeah, I think, I found Black friendly places. It's mainly Black, like where Black people are the majority. But even then, I also have to think about my womanhood, and that complicates things as well.
What would you say to someone who may feel discouraged about traveling as a person of color?
I would say to talk to people. There's a contributor in this piece. Her name is Nneka Okonha, and I knew when I wrote this, when I was curating this anthology, that she had to be in it because she has traveled everywhere. She's been all over the world. I think right now she's living in Spain. And so hearing the narratives of people, I know there's travel noir. It's like a movement that, you know, you can read about other people's narratives, but also, but it's just like, this is going to sound really simplistic, but if you have survived in America, I think it'll be okay for you to go to Italy, to be frank with you. Now, if you ask me how I want to go to Russia, then we can talk a little bit more about that because of the heightened presence of neo-Nazis, like I said. But in terms of Italy, I feel like if you can survive here, you can survive there.
What would you like to see change to make traveling a better experience for people of color?
You know what? Tourism, the tours that I go on. So when I was doing field research in the South, a lot of times I would have to visit these historical sites that have to do with slavery. I had to also do plantation tours or visit, islands that were once populated by Black ethnic groups that aren't anymore. And the main people that would be on those tours were white people. And because of that, the tour guides would have to change the narratives and say they instead of white people, or try to basically flatten how brutal these systems were. And it makes you wonder, like, who are you talking to, me or them? You know what I'm saying? I think one of the things that I really loved when I just came back from Mexico and I visited this Mayan archaeological site. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and it's called Chichen Itza, and it's 2.5 hours from Cancun. And the tour guide told me, he started off the trip by saying that, you know, history belongs to the winners. The winners are the ones, particularly the colonizers, in their case, the Spaniards, were the ones who document the history. So it was very important for him, who is half Mayan, who can read and write in the dialect, only 1 out of 100 people can do so, to be able to curate these tours. So I think, you know, when you're looking overseas and you're trying to find ways in which to create these experiences that cater to you, make sure you look for those who are part of the neighborhood who focus on history and are, you know, who will, you, no holds bar. A lot of times it very much catered to white people because they assume white people have the money.
Morgan, thank you so much for joining us today and for editing Traveling While Black. I hope a TSA employee never puts their fingers in your hair ever again.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can check out the full collection at read.medium.com/traveling.
Thank you so much, Kara. I'm a big fan, so this was awesome. Thank you.
And thank you so much for listening to Playback. Look out for future episodes where we'll continue to share inspiring stories read by some of our best writers. You can find the new episodes in the audio section of the Medium app. If you're on iOS, tap the headphone icon at the top of the app. On Android, click audio from the menu bar. You can also subscribe to Medium Playback and leave us a review, if you're so inclined, wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm your host, Kara Brown, and this episode was produced by Rachel King and Leah Rose for Pod People and Sam Duboff and Alex McManus for Medium. If there's an author or story you'd like to hear on Playback, we'd love to hear from you. Send us a note on Twitter, we're @Medium, or email playback@medium.com. We'll see you next time.